Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 24th, 2002. Today's session is titled People Longing for Peace in the Middle East, presented by Anne Hafton. The session number is HAA 2002-01. Let's listen in.
This session is called People Longing for Peace in the Middle East, and we'll begin now. First, I should say a little bit about myself and what gives me a credential to talk about this. For one thing, I started a new job in May that I'm very excited about. I work for the ELCA's Division for Global Mission. My title is Coordinator for Middle East Networking. What that means is I'm working part-time on a one-year contract to help congregations get in touch with the grassroots groups, the agencies, and other people, the resources that they need to be informed and to become active around Middle East issues. Active could mean prayer, it can mean advocacy, it can mean getting together with other people and pushing the news about peacemaking out into their community, in ecumenical groups or in community groups. So it can take a number of different forms. And at the end of this session, if you're interested in more about that work, you can pick up one of these blue sheets that has my email address on it, or just ask me anytime tonight or tomorrow, and I'll tell you about that. My personal background includes, I think it's 12 trips now to the Middle East. And I went there first as a very young person, a student, in 1977. I knew some people from here at Holden who had worked on a kibbutz in Israel. And because of my involvement in Holden and its emphasis on community, I was interested in this other form of living in community, the kibbutz socialist communal farm. So after my first kind of Holy Land trip as a student of art and the history of the church, I returned in 1978 and lived for 6 months on a kibbutz in Israel. Israel proper, I emphasize, not in the West Bank. And there I came in contact with a lot of great people, and I had a wonderful experience. I learned about a community that was not based on worship, as ours is, but on labor, on work. And I had a wonderful growing experience as a 26-year-old. And then in the subsequent years, I returned frequently to this farm to visit and spend time with my friends there. And I didn't know in the whole time that I was working there that I was close enough to the Gaza Strip to have ridden my bike there if I wanted to. Today I'm in pretty good shape riding a bike. It's very close, really, probably not more than 26 or 27 miles away. That shows you the kind of isolation that the people of the Middle East live in. The people at the farm where I worked had no real awareness that they were, and they knew, in a way, they knew that they were close to the Gaza Strip, but they had never been there, would never go there, had no reason to know anyone from there. And the same kind of insulation occurs on each of the different sides in this issue, where on the Palestinian side in the West Bank, that is not a self-imposed insulation, but an isolation that is imposed by the curfews and the closures that they live under. So I was for a time working for the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College and had the privilege of taking several groups to Jordan, the West Bank, and Israel and Gaza. And have returned with my husband to visit our friends again as recently as a year ago in February. That would be since this last intifada began, but before the incursions that made it so much more terribly violent. So my background in the region is really not a scholarly one, but one of personal experience. And that's a little bit of what I'd like to share with you tonight, because as complex as the issues are there, I have, in my own experience, felt the best starting point is the people I know and the human side of of the way they feel and the way they view things. So I thought I'd just introduce you to a few people I know and let you get a little bit acquainted with them and envision them or hear their voices. And then maybe you can tell me a little bit about some people you might know from that area. Maybe you've had a visitor from the Middle East come to your congregation or know someone in your work setting. I heard a story that I want to share. A man writes this. Once I sat on the steps at David's Tower. It's in Jerusalem in the corner near the Jaffa Gate in the Jewish controlled area. He says, I placed my two heavy baskets at my side. A group of tourists was standing around their guide, and I became their target. You see that man with the baskets? The guide said. Well, just to the right of his head, there's an arch from the Roman period. Just look to the right of his head. And I said to myself, redemption will come only if this guide tells them. You see that arch from the Roman period? It's not important. But next to it, left and down a bit, there sits a man who's bought fruit and vegetables for his family. So we try to view people apart a little bit from the stances that their communities have come to represent. One very close friend is a woman named Liska. She's an Israeli, about my mother's age, let's say 78. She came to what was then Palestine immediately after World War II from Poland. She was a young woman, maybe about 19. Her family had been Jews in Poland, and when the Nazis occupied her small city, she and her mother, her aunties and sisters were all herded together and separated into the famous two lines, the one line that went to Auschwitz and the other that held some people back in a prison camp there in their own city, in their ghetto. She was about 16 years old, and she and some other young people managed to escape from this prison under the wall and run out into the forests of Poland. And their hope was to join the Polish partisans, the leftists who were fighting the Nazis. They were closely associated with the communists. And they had no idea how they would be treated or what they would find, but they knew that there was only death behind them in the city. So they fled to the forest and made their way just foraging off the what they could find to eat and trying to keep a low profile so no one would send them back to the Nazis. And she spent 3 years there with other people in the woods. She carried a gun at one time. She did finally manage to join the partisans who were fighting the Nazis, but it was not at all easy, and there was a lot of sort of racism against her and the other young Jews who were with her at that time, too. So while they escaped the Nazis, they had a very rough time there in the forest during the war. She survived, and at the end became a refugee and went to Palestine. And there she became part of the movement, the kibbutz movement that wanted to form a new Zionist state, a safe haven for the Jews, and a setting where Jews could farm and live self-sufficiently in a community setting. And she raised her children there, and her children fought in the wars that followed. And she always had a lot of hope because she's clearly someone who knows how to survive and knows how to make something out of nothing. And I always loved visiting with her and having coffee, and she would always show me pictures of her children and who they had married and the grandchildren. And she has done some writing as well about her story. But the sad thing for me on our last visit in February was that she had become so discouraged and so frustrated with her own country that she tries to spend as much time abroad as she can. And it was a terrible thing, and I have lots of judgments about Israel, but it was a terrible thing to see a woman who survived to become a nation builder. Now at the point in her life when she ought to be able to enjoy the fruits of a productive life, and she has only despair about the results, and only disappointment in the country that she helped to build. So that was a sad, coffee party with her, and I hope to see her again someday, but I don't know if I'll ever see her spirits lifted. I was very sad to see her. On the other side of the line that was drawn at the end of the 1967 war is my friend Bassam, Hester Bassam Banura. He's a Palestinian evangelical pastor. He's not a Lutheran. He's a little younger than me, which would make him about 45. He was trained in the Mennonite Seminary in Indiana and returned to his home, which is just outside of Bethlehem in the town of Beit Zachur. It's the town best known as the home of the shepherds' visit to the angels' visit to the shepherds. And when Holy Land tours go, the buses come through to the designated spot where they celebrate this visit of the angels to the shepherds to announce Jesus' birth. Beit Zachur is historically a Christian town, and Bassam was raised Greek Orthodox, like most of the residents there. He had his own experience, though, and became an evangelical Christian and trained to have his own ministry, particularly in outreach to disaffected Muslims. And it's very interesting to hear him tell about his work, and he also has a little mission congregation that's in a little storefront. And I first met him in 1989 when I went with a group to observe the second anniversary of the first intifada, the less violent intifada. And we had an opportunity to stay in people's homes. And so together with a Baptist activist from Georgia and a rabbi from San Francisco, and I, the three of us, stayed in the home of this nice young couple, Bassam and Ian Banura, and their children. And so we stayed friends. We corresponded, and whenever I go back to the region, I always go and see him. The hardest thing for my Israeli friends to understand, and they always ask again and again, now who is it that you're going to see? And I say, well, this family, he's a pastor, and he's in the West Bank. And how do you know him? And I say, well, he's a friend of mine. It's just kind of inconceivable to the average Israeli that you would have friends among Palestinians. And I'd say it's probably just about as inconceivable among the Palestinians that I have these heart friends on the other side in Israel. It's very, very hard for them to see one another. There's too much in the way. Well, Bassam has always had a lot of positive force. He's a go-getter. He wants to start a congregation. He wants to build a church. He wants to convert the unbelievers to Christianity. And he's always had a lot of hope and a lot of go power. On this past visit, he welcomed us just as always, very generously. We stayed in his home. We enjoyed the meals and also worshiping with their congregation. But he's more bitter than I've seen him before. His own family once owned a part of the hillside that became a Jewish settlement, an Israeli settlement. Only in about 95. 94 or 95, called Har Homa. Very heavily contested settlement. It pushes the boundaries of Jerusalem out farther than ever, right into the backyards of the Palestinian cities of Beit Zahur and Bethlehem. So much in the backyard that this land that was his family's was confiscated and lost to them. They can see it, but they can't go over there. If they did, they would be at the least apprehended and sent back. But in today's climate, probably shot. It wasn't that way when we were there in February a year ago, but he still couldn't go there, and his family has no claim on that land anymore. He's not a farmer. He's not concerned with land holdings in the agricultural world. He's a pastor. But it's just natural that in him there's a resentment and a bitterness that is... It feels to me like it's finally come out. His great kind of boundless hope and always on the go cheeriness has finally given way a little bit to this resentment and this bitterness that is there. And why not? It's very difficult to comfort him in any way. Still, he is a preacher of the gospel, and that's the area where he will not be slowed down. He is in that pulpit, and he is preaching the love of Christ every single week. And so he doesn't have much hope for political solutions or any hope of getting their family recovering that real estate. But he has a lot of hope in the faith in Jesus. And so it's not all so gloomy to visit Bassam. Even though the situation is bad. And he has enough spunk that when we were leaving the West Bank and going back into Israel and then toward Jerusalem, they stopped our car. And because Bassam was driving it and he had Palestinian plates, and we just wanted to make it easy. We said, let's just get out and we'll just take our luggage and we'll walk from here. He wouldn't have it. He said, we can drive a little farther. They don't have to stop us way back here. We can move up a bit. And so we inched along, and then we got up to a certain point, and right away, of course, a soldier came around and said, you have to leave this area. You have to go. And he's speaking right to Bassam, not to us. You must go. Go, get this car out of here now. And he said, I'm only dropping off my friends. Let me help them with their luggage. No, this person was insistent. You must back up. Just back up, leave. You can't come any further. And he stood his ground. He said, I'm going to help my friends get out of the car, and it will only take a minute. So he just opened the car door like this and stood up. He's not as tall as me. And by gosh, opened up our back seat in the trunk and helped us with our luggage, and the soldiers stood there yelling at him. But it just it showed me that he wasn't defeated, despite the ridiculous, you know, humiliation. He was still Bassam. He's a good friend, and we pray for one another. We have a covenant. On that same trip, when I met Bassam in 1989, I met a young girl in the Gaza Strip. Her name was Manar El-Kig. She was part of a big family of Gazans, and they lived in the town of Rafia. It's the furthest south town in the Gaza Strip. They didn't live in a refugee camp because when the war, when the first war broke out in 1948, they lived in the town already. And a lot, most other people, many, many, many people who live in the Gaza Strip are refugees who have come from further up the coast and fled to the Gaza Strip, and they remain in refugee camps now. But her family was from the town, so they had some houses. One of the houses that belonged to their family had been demolished because one of the boys had been suspected of stone throwing, This was in the earlier Intifada. And out of the whole family, they lived in the Arab style, where a couple of families lived together in one big house with, like, sectors over here. This uncle and his family over here, her father and his family, and on this level, another, you know, young uncle and his bride. So we were housed there, several of us, to stay two nights. And almost none of the women spoke English. And because we were guests, we were honored to sit in the room with all the men all the time, but, you know, that got a little bit old. I wanted to talk to some other women, but all the other women didn't speak English. Only Manar, who was a student at the secondary school in Gaza City, spoke English, and she was about 16. And so we had really nice conversations over those couple of days. She was very concerned about the future. Her one of her uncle's home had been demolished, as I said, so that uncle and his family had moved in to their house. Another one of her younger uncles was imprisoned, suspected of planning some kind of violence. We don't know if he... what was really going on, because he was never tried or convicted, only imprisoned indefinitely. And he, his young wife and her baby were my roommates in that house. Two of her other cousins had been martyred in one way or another, which is the expression they use not only for this didn't involve suicide bombers at all, but only anyone who had been killed in the struggle. So there was a lot of loss in that household, including the most recent house demolition. But she was very concerned about her younger brothers and their friends. She said her household was not the most conservative Muslim household, but still the girls didn't go out too much. They went to school, they came home. That's pretty much it. But the boys could run freely in the streets and get into trouble, get involved in stone throwing, and she was very worried about her little brothers and cousins that they would get shot or broken up in some way, beaten. And she was also concerned about what kind of future there was for herself as a young person and for her her cohort, the other young people. So she said at the end that she still had hope. And I took a lot away from that. We wrote several letters back and forth, and she always said, you know, despite all the difficulties, I still have hope. Does she sound a little like Anne Frank to you? Yeah, she did to me. She was like my little personal Anne Frank. But I have to say that I've lost touch with her. And it could be that my letters are not addressed properly, or could be that she's now grown up and married and moved to another community. And I sent her a wedding announcement a few weeks ago, but I don't really think that I'll ever hear from her again. I'm sad about it, but still I hold on to her because she was a young person in a terrible situation who had had a promise. She held on to the promise that there would be a future for her and for people her age. So I keep her face in my mind. I have another Israeli friend who is not a rabbi, but a theologian. His name is Yeheskel Landau. He lives in Jerusalem. He wears a skull cap. He's an observant Jew. He comes from the United States. He married a woman from a town, what's the name of that town? Not far from my kibbutz, which was once an all-Arab town, an all-Palestinian town, and was subjected to forced evacuation in 1948. And so all the Palestinian population essentially left that city, Ramla, that's what it's called. And then in the years that followed the Israelis settled Jewish immigrants in all those homes. And among those immigrants were Dalia Landau's parents. So she grew up in Ramla in a house that was owned by, had previously been owned by Palestinians. And Yeheskel is very active in the peace movement. He's also very discouraged, but he keeps plugging along. He keeps writing, he keeps talking on the radio, he keeps working and looking for concrete ways to make a difference. He will not serve in the West Bank when he goes on reserves, but he still goes to the army. Now, some peaceniks in Israel say if you don't want to take part, don't take part in the military at all. But he has a way of thinking about it that says he can should serve in the military because he is a Zionist and he is a Jew, an Israeli, he needs to be in the military. But he doesn't have to serve in the West Bank. So he's worked that out in his mind. And it's it just shows how a person struggles to figure out, how do I find my way through this in a way that has meaning for my beliefs, my values, and what I teach and what I stand for. And some of my peace friends will say, referring to him, will say, well, your friend Yeheskel Landau, because they don't think he's far enough to the left. He still accommodates to a certain extent. But I love him because he does think about things theologically. He's interested in the redemption of the Jewish state. He really believes that Zionism is his calling and is a righteous cause, that God has a place for Jews in Israel. But under no circumstances does that mean displacing any more Palestinians, building any more settlements. He's very active against most of the oppressive tactics of the Israelis. So he walks a very, very fine line, a very tough, tightrope. One thing he and his wife Dalia have done that's very on the ground is taken this house. Well, backing up a little bit, Dalia got into a correspondence with one of the former family members of the house that she grew up in. It'd be a little bit like one time when we were redecorating our house, my dad persuaded us kids to put a time capsule in between the wall, and we built it out of a shoebox, and we put in the newspaper and some things about our life and our church and schoolwork and so forth. Well, so she found the people that had lived in this house before Ramla was evacuated. And the way she found them was because one of them had been a terrorist and he was in prison and his name and was all right there. So she began a correspondence with him and the family, who had all refugeed to the West Bank. And they formed a relationship and they invited them to visit. And finally, she decided that they couldn't reside there in a righteous way. If this Arab family who'd been thrown out could not have the house, that they shouldn't have it either. So they are working together with Palestinians in Ramla to make a community center there. And it's pretty successful. It's been going now for, I think, about 13 or 14 years. And they have education and after-school programs and preschool and mother-child programs for Israelis and Palestinians in this town, and lots of activities to try to bring people together, at least at this level, in this place, which is in Israel. So they're still working. They're still trying. And so I tell you about these six people because as we hear on the radio and read, see the images of violence and terror and oppression and the setting that I'll be talking more about in this week, it helps me to know, and I want you to know, that there are people there who have faces and names and stories and lives, and they haven't given up. They're still trying, and they're still living and believing in the power of hope and faith in some of them, and in the power of life every day. They haven't given up. So I wonder if you know anyone that has a name and a face that you've met or that you know that you want to share? Has anyone here ever met Palestinian or Israeli people? Has anyone been on a Holy Land trip? Uh-huh. Who did you meet?
We didn't. We were really insulated from connecting with anybody. That was through educational opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And they really isolated.
Yeah, it's hard to take a Holy Land tour that isn't manipulated by somebody. Well, I invite you to try to meet some of these people, if not personally, directly, the way I've had the blessing to, then in your reading and in your own self-education, or invite someone to your church, or ask me and I'll put you in touch with someone that you can have as a pen pal or bring to into your community as a speaker. One of the things that was interesting to me two weeks ago at the ELCA Global Mission event. This was at an event I was at in Chicago. I heard one of our ELCA missionaries give a presentation, and he said something. He quoted an Israeli peace activist. And I thought, you know, I think I've heard that before. So I'm going to read a little section of it, and then I'll tell you where I heard it before. This Jeff Halper is very active. He's the founder of a group called the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition. And they are working very hard to counter this terrible retribution to tearing people's homes down, and also the illegal confiscation and demolition of homes. I think I read last week that 6,000 homes have been demolished for one reason or another in the West Bank and Jerusalem, the Jerusalem area. And he talks about the concept of sides. There's a perception that, indeed an expectation, that Israelis and Palestinians will be on separate, conflicting, and irreconcilable sides of what is called the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I would like to declare at the outset that I do not locate myself on either of those sides. For me, as an Israeli Jew, sides mean something different altogether. I am on the side of Israelis and Palestinians who seek a just peace that addresses Palestinian rights of self-determination, as well as Israeli concerns of security and regional integration. I am on the side that stands for equality, human rights, democracy, peaceful coexistence. To be sure, there is another side, those Israelis and Palestinians that advocate exclusivity, conflict, a win-lose mentality, continued injustice and suffering. That is the way the sides divide, not Israeli-Palestinian. I thought, where have I heard that before? Well, last summer in Indianapolis, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America had its assembly. And one of its guests was a woman named Viola Raheb from Bethlehem. She is a wonderful young woman. She's an education administrator, and she said to the that there had been some squabbling on the floor of the assembly, and she got up and spoke to them in a way that they're really not used to being spoken to. But I was watching it on my computer, and I thought, yeah. She said, "You people ought to spend less time trying to figure out whose side you're on, and more time getting on the side of the people who are working for peace. And they are Israelis, Palestinians, Christians, Jews, and Muslims." And I thought, well, preach it, sister. You know, at last someone had said something that made some sense to me. And I kind of adopted that idea as my own touchstone for the way I want to try to do this work, which is to not to stereotype people or look at kind of rigid ways of seeing people, but to get to look for people who are working for peace and get with them. And they may be an evangelical pastor who's not a Lutheran. They might be a little Muslim girl in Gaza or any of the folks that I've outlined to you. But they are the people that hope and long for peace. And they're the people whose side I want to be on. Sometimes it's a good idea to stop and give you a chance to ask questions about the situation in general or these folks that I've introduced before I go on. Yes?
How do you suggest that those peace workers can beat it into the heads of those hawks on both sides?
Yeah.
How is that going to evolve?
It's tough because the hawks are human beings too, but boy, it's difficult, especially because even those leaders who are also people with names and faces have kind of formed, they've hardened in our own minds. When we see Arafat and we see how duplicitous and ineffective he's been, and Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel, who President Bush called a man of peace, is about as much a man of peace as William Tecumseh Sherman. Those people are not the folks that we're going to have any contact with, or President Bush either, for that matter. But I think that those, what people like Yehezkel Landau, the Israeli peace worker that I know, try to do is to get around the fear and the the fear of death. That people who are the aggressors, that are the hawks you described, most of them are operating out of a combination of fear and greed. And how many of us know what that's about, you know? For example, most of the settlers, the majority of settlers in the West Bank are not religious fanatics. They're, I think, maybe 23%, I read the other day, are people who are there for really religious or what we might call ideological reasons. Most of them are there because the government gave them a nice subsidy to get a new condo in a setting which was a reasonable commute to Tel Aviv. They're just people who have taken advantage of an economic deal. And so they're not hardliners. But who's going to give them another subsidy to move back to Israel proper? We don't know.
Sometimes we have uncontrollable forces, wild cards that are just screwing everything up. And with the best efforts of everybody, these random acts take place destructively and upset everything. I'm thinking specifically of countries outside of Israel with their own organizations, even as far away as Iraq, you know, that was sending Scud missiles in, and we have continued attacks. And it seems that the Palestinian Authority just doesn't have any control over these loose cannons on the outside that are lobbing in shells, sending in terrorists, suicide bombers, and make sure that there's pandemonium endlessly, which really is a poor setting for peace. Is there any control over that aspect?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you've described chaos, and that's what is a big part of the problem. This session is called People Longing for Peace, but there are people who do not want peace, and they will work against it. So that every time an agreement is discussed, or maybe a ceasefire, or the least movement. And it just happened just last week when the Israelis started talking about pulling out, the Palestinians started talking about settling down in very general terms. When I wasn't quite sure what was happening. I was reading the paper and trying to understand. But right away, the forces, the Hamas on the Palestinian side and the hard right in Israel both spoke right up to the press to say they would have nothing to do with this. Their interests are not served by a peace settlement because they won't win what they want, which is power for themselves. So that's a hard one. That's a very hard one. I think those outside forces are also working now. For example, the Iraqis and the Saudis and the Syrians as well.
The Syrians, yes, for sure.
They have no particular interest in the Palestinians or their statehood, but they use it as a way to attack Israel.
Yes.
So you kind of have to, in reading and studying, you kind of have to look through some of that and try to see. At least I do. I try to kind of see what's true. What can I understand? and where there's chaos, the way you describe it, it's very, very hard. If you don't want to, I can't become a policy analyst, you know. But I think, and most people in the region don't know how these forces work either. And that's why they're so fearful.
Well, that was a good, honest answer. Thank you.
Well, it's a quagmire, really. It's very. That's why I tried to start out talking about the folks I do know, the folks I spend time with when I'm in the region and love. So, anything else?
Yeah, I'd like to know a little more historically. Now, it's been my understanding that in 1948, when the first war was about to occur, the Arab countries had gone to the Palestinians living in Israel, or in Palestine at that time. Or no, they'd been declared, Israel had declared itself a state by then. And they said, "You guys, you Palestinians, pull out, and we're going to drive the Jews into the sea. And in a week, and you can come back, and you can have the Jew land, you can have your own land, and have it all." And of course, they didn't win the war. The Arabs didn't win the war. And the Palestinians have been located in the West Bank ever since. And now you were alluding to the fact that the Jews drove the Palestinians out, and it was my understanding that that's not necessarily true. It may have occurred after the time of that war. And the Arab countries wouldn't even accept the Palestinians at that time, so they've been located there with the UN supporting them and 90% of that being paid by the United States for that 60 years.
Yeah.
Not quite.
There's a... operating in the Middle East, there are at least a couple or more dominant myths. And one... And it's interesting because each of the people that I've talked about and then I... No, they accept would be unwilling to relinquish their own cultural and national myth. One of the myths among the Israelis is the one you describe. We tried to help the Arabs. We broadcast on the radio and said, "Stay in your homes, you'll be okay." But the Arabs also broadcast to the radio and said, "Run, flee, the Israelis will kill you," as they did at Deir Yassin, where there was a massacre of Palestinians by a rogue group of Israeli army people, militia. And there was a lot of fear at work. So that's the Israeli myth. And the Palestinian myth is that all the people of Lod and Ramla and these other towns were driven out and could not return. Actually, my own assessment is that it's a little of both. I think there were, among my friends who were Israelis at that time, there... Kibbutz was very close to the southern edge of what was then Palestine. They were expecting an attack during the war of 2 years from Egypt. They were expecting the Germans, and they were trying to get ready for them. They lived in what they considered peaceful coexistence with the Palestinians of their neighborhood. The villages that had been there before they came and built their farm, of course, had to be relocated because they bought the land from an absentee landlord. And so, but to their way of seeing it, that was legal, so it was okay. And so they, those Palestinians relocated down the hill to a consolidated village. And then when this happened in 48, they were scared of those Palestinians. And they put their guard towers up, and they got ready with to defend themselves against what they thought was going to be a push. So each side has its way of seeing it. It has been revealed now in papers of David Ben-Gurion's in the the past 3 or 4 years. That actually those forced evacuations did occur. And most Israelis didn't know it and don't know it today. That, and it was a clear military decision on the part of the army in 48 that in advancing toward Jerusalem, which they felt they had to do, they could not leave their rear exposed and leave all the sympathetic Palestinian population behind them. So they pushed them this way, to the north, to Lebanon, to the south, to Gaza. They pushed them right out of their houses, and it's not, there's no question about it anymore. Now, did a lot of Palestinians flee because they were scared? Yeah, a lot did. They just left as fast as they could, and they probably did believe that they'd be able to come back.
As far as you're concerned, the rest of the Arab countries had no effect on these Palestinians, and that's
I don't
a
know.
That, you know.
No, I don't think it was a fallacy, because at that time there had been nation states in the Middle East for such a short time that most of the Arab population saw themselves as Arabs, and also Palestinians or Lebanese or Syrians, but they were all part of the kind of the Arab Brotherhood. And certainly they hoped that their Arab brothers would come and save them from having to live in an Israeli state. But it didn't work out that way, as you say. And the forces that were, the forces from Jordan and Syria were not coming to rescue the Palestinians. They were coming to take Palestine back themselves.
Yeah, they were going to drive the Jews into the sea.
From the European Jews. They had little concern about the Palestinians. Well, I'm going to deal a little bit more with this on another night this week, but yeah, that's a very kind of core myth that both of these groups have. Well, I wanted to introduce you to a couple of other people in my group, and then if you can take their images and their words away from here, we can bring some of these questions back on another night in the next couple of days, I hope. I had to choose a few and wrote out some words that I've heard them say. And I throw these out just so you can see how varied folks are, and how these myths and these stereotypes permeate their self-understanding, and how important it is to try to look beyond those stereotypes and those ways of kind of creating unhuman, making people less human. This is a friend of mine named Yehuda. We both know him. He's a farmer. He grows grapes in Israel. And he said this to me one time. Religious people won't agree with a word I say. I don't pray. I don't keep kosher. I don't do a single thing I should do. I'm a bad Jew. Ezra, my son, says I have inherited the people's belief in the prophet's belief in justice. Okay, I believe in justice. You can put it in the frame of religion if you want. You know about the Gentile who said to the rabbi, "Teach me how to be a Jew while I'm standing on one foot." The rabbi said, "This is the whole story. Love your fellow man as yourself. All the rest is commentary." If you want to believe this is the whole story, I am certainly a Jew. I don't feel bitter toward the Jordanians because of what they did in Jerusalem. Here's one of these myths coming. But it's not all myth. Some of it's real. During their occupation of the city after 1948, they completely destroyed the Jewish quarter, including the ancient synagogues. On the Mount of Olives, they took up gravestones to make paths and even put headstones down in the mud in the lavatories so that people wouldn't dirty their feet. I don't find this so terrible because these are the headstones of dead people. They're dead stones. It's not even a question of forgiveness. You can take revenge on people. You can't take revenge on governments. I mean, you can forgive or not forgive, but there's no point in not forgiving a government because it's a temporary thing, especially an Arab government. So here's somebody who's almost completely secular, and yet he has a concept of how he thinks about justice. He raises the issue of the destruction of the synagogues in the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem, which certainly happened. And then this touchstone myth in the Israeli community about the tombstones. Now on the Mount of Olives, there's a vast Jewish cemetery. And I no longer know who to believe about this tombstones problem. But apparently, we know that a lot of the top of this one sector of the Mount of Olives was cleared during the Jordanian time of Jordanian occupation between 1948 and 1967 to build a big intercontinental hotel. And so certainly, I'm sure tombstones were removed from there, and they weren't honored properly. And this, you know, but I don't know about this story about the lavatories. It just becomes something that becomes like a myth that takes on its own life. And, you know, after a while, you don't know what's true or what isn't. In 1994, I met Father Rhea, an Episcopal priest up in the Nazareth area. And he speaks a little bit to us as Christians and pilgrims. He said, "It troubles me the way pilgrims flock through this land every year, stopping at holy places, hearing a short lecture from their guide, snapping photos, and then boarding the bus again, all in 30 minutes or less. They only see the so-called holy places. The real holy places are the souls of the suffering. The souls of my people, the Palestinians. Down with the Holy Land. What matters is the living people, the living stones. We have been killed more by being labeled terrorists than by bullets. Not all Palestinians are terrorists. Not all Jews are non-terrorists. We feel like David threatening Goliath, but we don't come to cut off Goliath's head. We say instead, let us build a better land together. We're fit to become partners with the Jews because we have suffered the same way, in the same way as the Jews. You say to Israelis that anyone has suffered the same as the Jews, already you are in a very tender place. Because in Israeli culture, the Holocaust is unique. There's nothing else like it. And it doesn't matter what happened in the massacres before 1948 or the expulsion of the Palestinians or the incursions of last April. Nothing is the same, and don't compare them. Well, Palestinians do see a comparison. And I stay out of it, honestly, because I feel like my function is more to listen and hear both sides. I won't say that somebody's suffering on an individual basis, so it's different than someone else's suffering. But I think when Father Ria says, the holy places are the souls of the suffering, he knows something about both sides that's worth knowing about. And he speaks for not all, but some Palestinians who really do want to build a better land together. Nazareth is not in the West Bank, but is in Israel, and is not open to negotiation. So Father Ria and his congregation will live in Israel. That's the deal. And they need to look to ways to build the land together. So what do you hear from these voices that gives you any new insight or any hope or any... I did talk about some people that are kind of in despair, and we know that too, but I tried to find some voices that had hope in them as well. As you look at the situation, do you see ways that these voices resonate with some of what you feel? They're awfully far away, aren't they?
I think there's hope there, and I think there's despair with it. And, you know, it's hard to imagine those people living on both sides in that type of circumstance that they're, they would hope, but it still looks hopeless. It's just snowballing.
I look at places like Yugoslavia, and we had sides there that had animosities, and then the communists came in and really quelled all of the turmoil for decades, many decades. But as soon as they exited, people had long memories and were right again at each other's throats. And we intervened there, seeing some as the victims, but as soon as the apparent oppressors there had been taken care of, the victims turned right around and began doing a number of their own. I think in Afghanistan, there had been a long time, there was finally stability in Afghanistan, but the Soviet Union came in and just stirred everything up, broke down the structure, established effective anarchy, and I think it's going to take another many centuries before that could settle down again. I don't know what's going to happen in Israel, Palestine as it is today. That I think it's going to take an awfully long time until people can hammer out something of their own, but certainly not imposed by the United States or any other well-meaning organization.
Yeah, it would be great if they could solve their own problems. Yes?
Desmond Tutu and Mandela did wonders in South Africa to break down the barriers with the Truth and Reconciliation talks. And it seems to me that, until something like that happens, they're not going to get anywhere because the anxiety is so high on both sides in the leadership. Mm-hmm. That they're reptilian in all their responses.
Yeah, we look for someone like Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King in those communities. And so far it's there's still, as you say, there's still a lot of fear.
And the Christians are the ones who really have opportunity to do something. Seems to me.
Yeah, and so in many ways they try to. and I'll talk about that too. They have, they're, of course, they're a tiny minority, both in Israel and in the West Bank. They're a very, very small minority. And they are divided among themselves too. They're not unified. But the Lutheran bishop in Palestine, his name is Bishop Yonan, has done a lot, has been credited with doing a lot to bring the major Christian groups together, the Roman Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Anglicans, and some others, into a little group that they call the Heads of Churches. And they get... they actually make some progress in terms of making their presence known. They have to not be invisible. And in the last Intifada, it was really the Christian communities who led the nonviolent economic resistance and tax resistance. On the other hand, that was easier for them because they are also the more middle class. In the West Bank community. So I think we have some leadership there, and yet the Christian community is diminishing, rapidly going abroad if they can, getting a visa for education or emigrating. So that's a problem too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was... interested in something we said. All these sides, I think, various views in the national mess have the repercussions here in this country because it's such a diverse nation. And we now have sort of a religious right in this country. Instead of talking about peace as Christians, they talk increasingly about a very one-sided support for Israel. You have a growing Muslim population, pockets of which won't listen to any sort of voice either, in that sense. And so I wonder, as sort of a second part to your, I think you're very insight, what can we do perhaps as mainline Christians in this country to offer an alternative voice for peace other than the ones that are being heard? We, as Lutherans, and I work in an office in Washington, D.C., we do have access to the White House and some rather high-level decision makers for the president. I wonder what we can do. Of course, you play probably a central instrumental role in that. What do we do as congregations and as SMOs?
I didn't set up this question, but it's... Well, first, I think that your observation about the dynamics in American culture is a really important one, because as these things play out and people align themselves with one or another of these communities, either the Palestinian or the Muslim or the Christian or the Jewish, we become more and more fractured, and we operate more and more out of fear and insecurity instead of confidence. So that is something to watch closely in our own culture. But as for what we can do, there are a couple things that I'll tell you right now, and then it'll be time to close, but I want to get to your question. One is like the no-brainer that Christians can do, and that we know Muslims and Jews are doing too, which is pray. And pray in an organized way and in a fervent way for peace and for those who are working for peace. And if you want to join up, there's a way to join your congregation to a prayer vigil. It's operated by Churches for Middle East Peace, which is our ecumenical partner in Washington. The ELCA and the other mainland congregations advocate in Washington through Churches for Middle East Peace. And there are a number of ways to join that peace vigil. And if you want to, or that prayer vigil, and if you want to find out more about how to do it, just ask me or pick up this blue sheet and I'll tell you more about it. The other, and a very concrete thing you can do when you get home, is write a letter to President Bush and ask him to please welcome Bishop Yonan and the heads of churches when they come to visit Washington. Because to date we have not achieved what we are after there, which is for Bishop Yonan and our Bishop Hansen and two or three other church leaders from the Middle East to meet with President Bush. Up until this point, till last week, they're still saying you can meet with this or that State Department person. But they aren't getting into the White House, and they're holding out to meet with President Bush. And that would be our Bishop Mark Hansen, Bishop Yunnan, and two other leaders from the Middle East. So those are two things you can do.
Why don't you write their names on the board?
Sure.
I'm not sure everybody knows them.
Yep.
And if we talk amongst ourselves, we're wasting our time. If we take some kind of action like writing letters, something will happen.
Mm-hmm.
At least it's a vote.
Did you have one more thing to say?
Well, I think as a result of the attacks on September 11th, many communities are joining together with the Muslims and with Jews and moving toward organizations of religious leaders rather than the Christian congregations having like a clergy group for a particular area. We are, in Holland, Michigan, launching religious leaders of dialogue. And we know that it's going to be probably all Christians initially, but we're sending invitations mm-hmm. to those of the Jewish faith and the mm-hmm. Islamic faith and even Hindus and,
yep.
and Buddhists to at least have a forum of dialogue so that we can break down those barriers between the religions. And that's, I think, a concrete way. I know they're doing it in Lansing.
Particularly around peace and reconciliation or just general dialogue?
General dialogue initiative. We're launching it on the 3rd of September. So.
Well, I'm interested in finding models of that kind of activity. And in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's an interfaith peace group that is meeting and trying to be active. And if you know of these things, tell me, and I might get in touch with you later, because I do need to try to set forth models for
people that
can make a difference.
But I think that really addresses what you're talking about. I think more of that kind of activity is going to be really helpful in our own communities to advocate for breaking down.
I think we're out of time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank
hope to see you next week. Pick this up if you're interested in getting on our email list.
What are the titles of those two?
I'll write them up here. I wanted to, you know, sign off and then I can keep writing. Americans for Middle East Understanding.
Okay.
And this
and
particular...
available?
This is their... It's for sale in the bookstore, I'm
okay.
told.
Okay.
This one issue is dedicated to this lexicon or...
I'm going to find out about
it. Vocabulary list is what you call it, which I wanted to mention tonight because we always throw out these words like terrorist or whatever. And this was really prepared by journalists.
Yes,
including me, I was part of this project.
Okay.
This was my first call in journalism. And this was provided, was created for churches and church leaders to provide to journalists and also to use in their own writing of newsletters and but also to try to get the media to look harder at the way they use language. It's in the bookstore, and it's this whole issue is dedicated to that. It's also on their webpage.
Okay.
But if you download it, as I did the night at 1:30 in the morning when I was on my way here, it was 23 pages. Whereas here, because it's the layout, I couldn't get the PDF file to download for some reason that night.
Yeah, one of the things that we wrestled with our group, I'm Dennis.
Hi, Ann Hatcher.
How are you doing? Is how do we pray in this new group? I mean, this is Dutch Reformed territory. You know, how do we pray in this new group? And I was talking with Walt Bowman, and he said, you know, I have been respected because I up front say I'm a Christian. I can only pray as a Christian, and I'm going to speak as a Christian on these issues of Palestinians.
You know, I'm going to go back
and Jews.
I'm tired of them.
And he said he's gotten a lot more respect. People say, "Well, we know you're not trying to hide something."
Yeah,
something.
I think Walt is right in that you have to go into any interfaith or ecumenical setting
being authentic,
being who you are, which doesn't mean that you can't be nice about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and maybe praying isn't the thing you can do together. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't pray with the Missouri Synod. But
well, believe me, I know I came from there.
But maybe you can pray... I mean, you could talk about praying. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and as you leave, say to one another, I'll pray for you. Mm-hmm. And even make it personal.
Yeah.
But this, this webpage for Churches for Middle East Peace, do you know how to get to the ELC webpage?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If you go to the Lova webpage, Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, it's right there, the prayer vigil.
Okay.
And you click on it, and then you can join your congregation to the vigil.
Yeah.
And they provide a number of different forms of prayer. Some are, actually, I printed the webpage out to bring it with me. One is more liturgical, one is straight up, one is a little bit more political, one is less so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Responsive.
Yeah, responsive.
So they have an assortment of different MOs.
That's good.
And I think really. I mean, I would say, I mean, just my personal, is that just getting together isn't enough anymore. But that's why I'm inspired. Franz knows a guy in Dallas, Fort Worth, who's just working like a little, you know, dog, trying to get this interfaith group to really work on these peace issues together. And that's hard. But, you know, they're actually moving out of just getting acquainted.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So.
And this is Francis?
Yes. Sorry, my husband. Francis. Dennis, right?
Dennis, right. Schimmel.
Ooh.
Is that S-C-H-M-M-M?
S-C-H-E-M-M-E-L. Yeah. You know, we're not sure who really do the guy with the eyes, too. You know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it's difficult. We have, actually speaking of, there's a couple of Muslims that come. And on account of that, so I know we've been having a really hard time engaging any...
Now the Christian and the fundamentalists.
Well, the fundamentalists won't come, and the Jewish folks won't come either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So the situation is becoming, you know, has seemed to polarize, I think, since last year.
I'll have to talk to my colleague, Lance, who's doing the interim ministry at the University of Lutheran. The mosque is just down the street, and they've had a good relationship with that imam over there.
Wow.
And have had a number of dialogues since September.
Well, one of the problems we talked about when I was at this meeting in Washington, and it's debatable whether it's true or not, but, you know, the churches, not the denominations, but the congregations got real quiet around the time of these incursions into the West Bank and the violence at Jenin and these other places. And they just weren't the same, and like they were about apartheid or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's a lot of factors going on there. I mean, the terrorists, suicide bombers were the worst factor to try to deal with, but mostly what the consensus seemed to be is that they've just kind of gone quiet. They don't want to jeopardize the relationships they formed in their own community with Jewish leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's good, been a lot of work out of that.
They've been working on it for years, and they've got friendships there, and they've got something in place that's working for them, and they don't want to jeopardize it. So,
well, there are those Jews that feel that 48 should never have happened.
Well, I mean, they're all, but they're, yeah, I mean, right now the communities are just so polarized. People that liberal cities are being up with, thank you.